FM and click on the button marked Donate. Teresa Mitchell is next with Press Watch on KABU.
Support KABU by entering the Ultimate KABU Neighborhood Raffle. For the next 3 days, we're raffling off a package to a lucky winner to experience our great KABU neighborhood. For every $20 you donate at kabu.fm/give, you will gain one entry. The package includes several gift cards to shops in our community, including Grendel's Cafe, Hammer and Nails, Hattie's Vintage, and Sizzle Pie, and a meal and night stay at the Doug Fir and Jupiter Hotel. Again, for the next 3 days, participate in the Ultimate KABU Neighborhood Raffle. Donate today at kabu.fm/give.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Today, high crimes and misdemeanors. Starting with, well, let's see, shall we start with Benjamin Netanyahu or with Donald Trump? I say let's start with Benjamin because it just all sounds so familiar. Israel's attorney general announced today that his office had indicted Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on corruption charges. After a two-year investigation, the prime minister faces one count of bribery and two counts of fraud and breach of trust. Police have previously recommended indicting Netanyahu for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in three different cases. The most serious allegations against Netanyahu involve his relationship with Shaul Elovich, the controlling shareholder of Israel's telecom giant Bezeq. Police recommended an indictment in the case based on evidence collected that confidants of Netanyahu promoted regulatory changes worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Bezeq. In exchange, they believe Netanyahu used his connections with Elovich to receive positive press coverage on Bezeq's popular subsidiary news site Walla. Police said their investigation concluded that Netanyahu and Elovich engaged in a bribe-based relationship. Police also recommended charges be brought against Elovich, members of his family, and members of his Bezeq management team. That's from NBC News. If you turn to Haaretz, they write, Mendelblit's decision comes after 3 years of investigations, and it marks the first time in Israel's history that an attorney general announces an indictment for bribery against an incumbent prime minister. Mendelblit wrote to Netanyahu in his decision saying, quote, you have hurt the image of public service and public faith in it. You acted in a conflict of interest. You abused your authority while taking into account other considerations that relate to your personal interests and the interests of your family. You corrupted public servants working under you, end quote. Sound familiar? You can find more at haaretz.com. Which brings me to Trump. From The Guardian, Donald Trump's former attorney Michael Cohen accused the president in explosive public testimony yesterday before Congress of knowing in advance about key events under investigation in the Russia inquiry and of committing criminal conspiracy in the covering up of an extramarital affair. Now, I'll bet you know about this. So I'm just going to continue reading a bit more of this, and I'm inviting your calls and comments, 503-231-8187. In a day of high drama before the House Oversight Committee, Cohen delivered a string of bombshells that could spawn fresh investigations by Congress and the FBI. Testifying on Wednesday, he labeled the U.S. president a racist and a con man, produced signed checks that he said were proof of a fraudulently designed conspiracy, that is, to silence a former adult film actor. Nice way to put it, huh? And he gave what he claimed were eyewitness accounts that implied Trump had prior knowledge of crucial Russia links. Cohen became the first in the president's inner circle to allege that Trump knew that his longtime advisor, Roger Stone, was communicating with WikiLeaks during the 2016 election regarding the release of hacked Democratic Party emails. He also said Trump was aware of the infamous Trump Tower meeting between members of his presidential campaign, including his son Donald Trump Jr., and a Russian lawyer with ties to the Kremlin, which was arranged in order to receive damaging information about Hillary Clinton. Cohen's testimony marked a rare opportunity for millions of Americans to bear witness to the account of a central player in multiple investigations ensnaring the president and associates. Cohen acted for more than a decade as the president's fixer, a role in which he became intimately familiar with both Trump's personal and professional affairs. And speaking for myself, it also became obvious that Cohen was also a bit of an enforcer when he admitted that more than or around 500 times he had called and intimidated and threatened people on behalf of Trump. The Guardian writes, in an extraordinary and emotional closing statement, Cohen spoke directly to his former boss, admonishing Trump for a litany of sins ranging from his attacks against the media to his policy of separating immigrant families and his failure to take responsibility, quote, for your own dirty deeds, end quote. He exhorted those who still support the president, as he once did, not to make the same mistakes, quote, same mistakes I have made or pay the heavy price that my family and I are paying, end quote. In his most lurid warning, Cohen suggested that America could be facing existential peril as a constitutional democracy. Quote, given my experience working for Mr. Trump, I fear that if he loses the election in 2020, there will never be a peaceful transition of power, end quote. And that last part kind of gets my attention as well. What do you think? 503-231-8187. Cohen's testimony, stretching with breaks over more than 7 hours, highlighted how the U.S. president faces legal and political peril on at least two fronts: the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election and possible ties between the Trump campaign and Moscow, as well as a criminal conspiracy to violate campaign finance laws through the payment of hush money. And there it was for several hours, and it was popcorn worthy, certainly. Number to call, 503-231-8187. I'm going to continue with headline news. The Hanoi talks are off. So Kim Jong-un and President Trump have gone home. I noticed a similarity between Trump and the child rapist Cardinal Pell. That is, they are both fond of absolving other leaders of criminality, apparently in an effort to salve their own consciences, or more likely to lay the groundwork among the public for an easier acceptance of their crimes and predilections. Cardinal Pell is quick to assert that someone accused of priestly pederasty might be wrongly accused, and Trump believes dictators when they come out with their ridiculous denials of culpability. He believes Kim Jong-un, he says, the absolute autocrat of North Korea. When Kim says he was unaware of the condition of his former premier hostage, Otto Warmbier. He believes Putin when he says Russia didn't interfere with U.S. elections. Heartwarming, isn't it? It's the solidarity of monsters. Continue with headlines from Radio Havana, Cuba. Following a request from the United States, the U.N. Security Council held an urgent session on Tuesday to discuss Venezuela and its internal political situation. This is the second session the Security Council held to discuss the political situation in Venezuela following a meeting on January 26th. Representatives from the United States, France, United Kingdom, Russia, China, Poland, Peru, the Dominican Republic, Belgium, South Africa, Kuwait, Germany, Indonesia, and Venezuela spoke to the international delegation. Despite the position held by some countries opposed to the Venezuelan government, their representatives have reiterated the rejection of the use of force by U.S. authorities. Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza called the international aggression a threat to Venezuela's sovereignty and the rights of a free people, as well as violation of the United Nations Charter. He's quoted saying, "Now is the time for us to return to sanity and respect international law and respect the Venezuelan Constitution. We are waiting to see the members of the Venezuelan opposition, Mr. Guaido and whoever else. They will decide who will sit down with the constitutional government of Venezuela. Then among Venezuelans, we can build our own solution without intervention or interference from anyone, much less the United States," end quote. The Bolivarian official thanked the members of the Montevideo mechanism for their support for peaceful dialogue and allowing the country to solve its differences domestically. He was quoted saying, "We are prepared to sit down and to come up with solutions to Mr. Guaido and whoever else wishes to sit down with us, but they don't want to sit down with us. They say there's no time for dialogue. Mr. Maduro has to go. The regime has to change. There has to be an invasion in Venezuela. But there's no call in the Security Council to say you have to sit down," end quote. Arreaza asked UN Security Council members to consider the fact that the United States is threatening to shoot migrants along its southern border, and what would happen if Venezuela, Nicaragua, or Cuba, all countries which have been burdened with U.S. intervention, were to intervene, citing a humanitarian crisis. Arreaza said, "What would the U.S. do if Cuba and Nicaragua attempted to enter their country to provide aid for the humanitarian crisis that is clearly taking place at the U.S. border?" He's quoted saying, Venezuela is staying out of the internal affairs of the United States in the electoral campaign here. There's a lot of hypocrisy and arrogance at play here, and this is what the UN Security Council should address. That's a quote. And the number to call, 503-231-8187. So I'll go to Mike. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I have told everybody from the time he got elected, he has no intention of leaving that office peacefully. And the Secret Service or somebody better keep a real close eye on him, because if they try to take him out and they try to get him out, they better grab his arms, because he's going to go for that briefcase and that darn black button, and he's going to blow us all up. It's war footing with him. The guy is what do they call it, unbalanced, psychopath?
I am worried about him. I mean, he has painted himself in a corner. He has criminal indictments waiting for him, and the authorities are reluctant to indict a sitting president, but they won't be reluctant once he is out of office.
Yeah, the problem is we all know how he acts. This is war, you know, and then 6 weeks ago or 5 weeks ago, he made that statement, if things don't go my way, it's war. And, you know, he's a total psychopath. I mean, we got to pray. I mean, you know, Syria, the border, Venezuela, they're bad issues. But he's going to blow us all up unless someone restrains him at the final moments. He's going down no matter what. The question is, are we all going down with him?
Well, that's a pretty grim thought, but I appreciate you calling in to share it with us.
You betcha. You do a great show, and I don't mean to be negative about it, but let's get real here, okay? And thank you for your show.
Thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187. It was chilling to hear Cohen say that he thought Trump wouldn't peacefully leave office. And many people said that even as he ran for office, that he just wasn't the type to respect the rule of law in any manner. And in fact, he isn't. And as I was saying, he can't afford to leave office ever. So what's he going to do? And I think that should provide impetus for impeachment. And let me talk about impeachment for a minute. This House hearing opened up with a ferocious effort, really just a frantic and panicked effort by the Republican members of the House Oversight Committee to shut it down. They really didn't want this to happen. They prevented it from happening for 2 years, but they're not the chair anymore, and they're not the majority in the House. And so Elijah Cummings was chairing, and I hope I got that name right, and he was rather impressive in his job. He presided rather well, I thought. But the first thing that Mr. Cummings had to do was fight back an attempt to shut down the whole procedure on a technicality, which is apparently cooked up overnight. I believe it was, they were saying they didn't have quite enough time to read Cohen's statements, even though it had been in the press overnight. Pardon me. But he was having none of that, and they did go forward. And it was interesting to see Cohen come out. And, of course, Cohen is a disgusting man. He was the toady of Trump for many years, and helped Trump cause all kinds of financial damage, helped Trump in his modus operandi of blustering, bullying, and bankruptcy, which is how he ran his businesses. And his remorse, well, part of it seemed real, and obviously he had a good reason to appear remorseful. But he also had good reason to bring as much dirt, as actual dirt, as he could out about Trump. So that was very interesting, especially the checks and documents, etc. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Now, Trump's ploy in Hanoi has failed. It's not surprising. Writing was on the wall before he went there, because as many observers had commented, the Kim Jong-un regime had no intention of removing their only good chess piece from the board, which is their nuclear weaponry. And so Trump demanded it once again, and I suppose Kim more clearly said no, and that was that. And so there's no negotiations happening in Hanoi. And so now Trump needs some other diversion. And he must be very tempted, especially with John Bolton and Elliot Abrams in his administration, drooling for war. He must be very tempted to attack Venezuela. That is not surprising, nor is it surprising to me that the corporate-owned media and the Democratic liberals, Democratic liberal establishment, is making it easy for him by repeating lies about Venezuela. So I have some further information from VenezuelaAnalysis.com, debunking four mistruths about Venezuela's humanitarian aid showdown. And I've been talking about this every week, but I am unapologetic for that because I'm going up against a corporate-owned press that constantly repeats straight-up lies about Venezuela. A corporate-owned press, which is very much in the game and seeking to promote those rivers of blood in the streets of Caracas. And make no mistake, that's what it's about. It's about killing people, intimidating people, and stealing that oil and gold. It isn't about humanitarian anything. The United States doesn't give a damn about humanitarian concerns. If it did, it wouldn't separate screaming families at the border. It wouldn't help Saudi Arabia bomb Yemen into starvation and cholera. The very idea that the U.S. stands for humanitarian aid is ridiculous. So I'm just going to put that out there. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And from the article I was referring to, February 23rd saw the latest attempt by the White House, its right-wing regional allies, and self-proclaimed interim president John Guaido to oust the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro, this time by trying to undermine Maduro's authority and forcibly violate Venezuela's border under the pretext of bringing in humanitarian aid. Given that not a single truck, boat, or plane entered the country and that Venezuela's armed forces remained steadfast in their defense of the national sovereignty, it can be said that Trump's and Guaido's primary objectives were a failure. And I just want to stop right there and say that does seem to be the case, and it also makes it more likely that Trump and Bolton would be calling for bloodshed. Returning to the article, they did, however, achieve some level of success in their secondary goal of further Satanizing Maduro in the eyes of the world. By provoking a series of violent confrontations along the Colombian and Brazilian borders, the Trump-backed opposition has managed to manufacture a false narrative designed to delegitimize the Maduro government and justify further foreign military intervention. This narrative has been uncritically disseminated by international corporate media. In what follows, we debunk four lies repeated ad nauseum by the mainstream press. First, who burnt the aid trucks? One of the oft-repeated lies is that Maduro ordered the burning of two large aid-laden trucks attempting to cross the bridge which connects Venezuela and Colombia in Ureña. Mainstream media latched onto the story, stating as fact that, quote, two trucks were burnt to a cinder and two were stolen by Mr. Maduro's forces, end quote. And that's from the Telegraph. A truck allegedly carrying aid from the USAID, I was reading a caption to a photograph, from a different angle in time snap, one can clearly see the burning truck carrying aid on the bridge some distance away from a Bolivarian National Guard outpost. The context here is crucial, as the images show the trucks burst into fire some 50 meters, 160 feet away from the piquet of the Venezuelan Bolivarian National Guard and the National Police. According to testimonies of right-wing protesters as well as Colombian policemen on either side of the bridge, the police forces used tear gas and rubber bullets, neither of which were flammable nor capable of penetrating the gas tank of a large truck. No live rounds, grenades, or flamethrowers were used by Venezuelan state security personnel as such. The claim that they set the trucks on fire is hard to fathom. By contrast, the opposition activists were seen hurling Molotov cocktails while standing only meters from the trucks. These reports were confirmed by on-the-spot journalists, including Telesur reporter Madeline Garcia and others. Moreover, Garcia reported it was the very same opposition militants who set fire to the truck, publishing photos that appear to show demonstrators pouring gasoline on the vehicles. So I will continue debunking the lies that are in the mainstream press that are promoting the invasion of Venezuela and the sanctions and the siege of Venezuela that is ongoing. And the number to call, 503-231-8187. And I go to the next caller.
Hi, Teresa, is that me?
Yes, that's you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you so much. All right, so I'm giving you this information from The Nation magazine.
Okay.
February 25th, March 4th of 2019.
Okay.
All right, according to this article, the end game is regime change in Cuba.
Interesting. Right? Okay.
That's what the end game is, because Venezuela is only the beginning, because Venezuela, as you know, has the fourth largest oil reserves in the world, and number 45, and John Bolton think that because Venezuela is in our hemisphere, that their oil belongs to us.
Well, it didn't seem to stop them from taking it from other hemispheres, so
not to belabor this, you remember Little Marco?
I'm sorry, there's a bit of noise. Can you say it again?
Little Marco, Marco Rubio?
Yes.
The senator from Florida?
Yes, he's very fired up about the Venezuela war.
Yeah, but he is an acting shadow Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs. That's his, according to this article.
Huh.
And he and of course he's owned by this guy named Mauricio Levan Conner, who's a Cuban American lobbyist and one of those right wing Cuban nut jobs. All right. So what I would suggest to our cable family is to go to The Nation. They have a website, thenation.com, and read this article for yourself.
Is it the one by Mark Weisbrot saying Trump's other national emergency?
Wait a minute. Let me give you the exact name of this article. Is Cuba next?
Okay.
All right. Venezuela isn't the only target on Trump's list.
Okay, thanks for that.
Okay, Teresa. Oh, by the way, I absolutely love what you do. Thank you so much. Keep on keeping on.
Well, thanks. Thanks for calling in.
Right.
Is Cuba next? I'm putting that into the search bar on The Nation magazine. And let's see. You know, these search bars don't always work right. In this case, it didn't work. But I'll bet it can be found. So is Cuba next on thenation.com? Okay, so I was debunking point by point four of the favorite memes against Venezuela that are in the corporate-owned news media. I was talking about those trucks. And Venezuela analysis is basically saying that not only was it not the Venezuelan government that burnt the trucks, but there is evidence, journalistic evidence, that it was the opposition protesters, the protesters that are in the pay of the U.S. end. They ask, of course, cui bono, who benefits from burning the trucks? It certainly couldn't have been Maduro, so, and it doesn't seem likely that he ordered his troops to do that. So, and there's several more points, but I can get to those in a moment because I believe I have another caller. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And Francis is on the air. You there, Francis? Okay, we may get back to Francis in just a moment. A second point that Venezuela analysis was bringing up was the question of whether the Maduro government is really blocking international humanitarian assistance. They write, another of the great mistruths circulating in international media is that the Bolivarian government, that's how they refer to Venezuela, Venezuelan government, Maduro's government, is blocking all international efforts to supply vital food and medicine, while The Guardian claims hungry Venezuelans living nearby are wondering when they will eat next. The truth, rather, is that Caracas has requested and is currently receiving international humanitarian assistance, especially from multilateral bodies like the International Red Cross, the United Nations, and regional healthcare organizations. The government has only blocked what these same humanitarian bodies have criticized as politicized aid, coming from the U.S. State Department's notorious USAID branch, which looks to instrumentalize aid as a tool of regime change. Only 48 hours before the February 23rd border showdown, Maduro announced that his government is coordinating $2 billion worth of technical humanitarian assistance with the United Nations and the EU-led International Contact Group. This is close to 20 times what the U.S. and its allies have pledged to Venezuela. While the contact group is yet to issue a formal comment, a statement from the EU some days later confirmed that the body has provided more than 60 million euros in 2018 and 2019 in international assistance to the country through official government channels. As a part of this aid, it was reported that Venezuelan authorities supplied the UN and the EU with a list of medicines which they have been unable to purchase in the international market, largely as a result of U.S.-led financial sanctions. They are requesting international assistance in purchasing these goods, offering to pay for them in full. And speaking for myself, that is the context of this whole thing, of course, is that the U.S. is knocking down Venezuela and then saying, oh, look, Venezuela's down. It's because they're socialist. Well, it has a lot to do with the fact that the U.S. has made it difficult, if not impossible, to sell that oil, those oil reserves that you keep hearing about, and has blocked the sale of gold, leading to a crisis. And I'll go to the next caller. Number to call, 503-231-8187.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, this is Francis.
Hi, Francis.
Unfortunately, it seems like this is not a new mode of operation for our country.
Well, no.
And didn't just start with the current president. You know, if you look back at Libya, that was an extreme tragedy, what happened there. And these sanctions, it sounds like that's the reason the talks ended in Korea, was because we wouldn't agree to lift any sanctions. So I don't know what gives us the authority to go around the world sanctioning people, but we do that quite a bit. And the regime change wars that we perpetrate, to me it's all international gangsterism, pretty much that's what it is, by corporations.
Well, it's international exceptionalism is the doctrine, and of course it's just as racist and chauvinist as it sounds.
Yeah. But back to the hearing yesterday, what's her name? The freshman congresswoman?
Ilhan Omar, Ocasio-Cortez?
Yes. Her questioning was, minus all the political dancing, it was straight, factual, to the point questions that pretty much put on record everything that needs to be put on record, and also provided a list of people that they should interview and documents that they should look for. And she did it in less than 5 minutes and actually gave back some of her time. She was quite impressive, and I was very happy to see that.
Not for the first time. It made me think, well, that's what representation should look like.
Exactly. And Congressman Cummings' final closing statements were pretty impressive also. You know, it's about preserving our Constitution and maintaining the rules of our Constitution, and all the political diatribe is getting really old, and it was pretty obvious when none of the Republicans actually came to the aid or defense of the president. They just continued to attack what's his name for being a liar, and dismissing the fact that the first time he lied to Congress was to protect the president. So it was pretty amazing, actually, what we witnessed yesterday.
Yeah, Cohen's obviously pretty slimy, but yeah, I think that the greater context does come into play.
That.
I mean, they were fine listening to Elliot Abrams, who's also been convicted for lying to Congress.
Right. But it I believe that this current president is in way over his head, and I think he has been playing some kind of a little gangster. But he's dealing with some international gangsterism that he's not ready for. And hopefully our government will be able to maintain the democracy as it is and move forward, because as what's happening right now is we're just going backwards really bad. So I don't even want to get into all the things that are going on in our country here internally, but I think they offered some a little peak of hope yesterday, just knowing that there's some people with some intelligence who are trying to get us back on track.
Well, I appreciate
you guys. Take care.
Yeah, thanks very much for your call, and I'll go to the next caller. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and I'm wondering what people think about the idea that Trump can't afford now to relinquish the presidency, and so therefore he won't, because he's Trump, and he'll face indictment and prison if he does. Number to call, 503-231-8187. I'll go to the next caller. Donna. Or is it Don? Hello, Donna. Let's see if Don is there. You, how about Tahana? Are you there?
Yes, Tahano.
Oh, Tahano, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. That's okay. First of all, I'd love to say that thank you so much for your fact-checking and your debunking. You are 100% on point as a brown individual here in Portland, being half Mexican, half Venezuelan, and speaking Spanish. It's interesting to me to follow Spanish media, which oftentimes doesn't censor anything, and I have to be sensitive with little ones in the room, and then see American mainstream media, and it's a very, very stark contrast, different. And everything you said about the trucks on the bridge, literally following, you know, hashtag hands off Venezuela, all the Spanish news outlets, you are 100% on point, and you're a breath of fresh air. I wanted to thank you for that.
Well, thanks.
Second, when, you know, you say, is it, do you think Trump will leave office silently? He will not. It's a power thing. But isn't it interesting that most of us that are like-minded comrades who feel like maybe there was collusion with Russia and getting Trump in office, and how we feel wrong, and how we now feel that we have this idiot, this fascist, this chauvinistic, this evil person in office. Isn't that interesting how we feel? Imagine what our Venezuelan comrades feel when you have Juan Guaido, who is literally backed by Marco Rubio, who is the king of all coconuts. He's brown on the outside, he's white on the inside, he's as evil and imperialistic as they come, literally backing Guaido. Guaido has the backing of the American government. We're basically doing to Venezuela what Russia was doing to us with Trump. Isn't that an interesting contrast?
Irony.
I also think there's different levels of end games to this. That one caller mentioned the end game, the end result was Cuba. That might be the thing, that might be the point, but I think there's so many. I think oil in Venezuela is one of them. Other resources in the area is one of them. Company interest is one of them. I think also, too, it has a lot to do with it, unfortunately, racism. I mean, we're kind of picking on brown socialists south of the border, right? I think if folks would have really have done their research on Chavez and what he did on flipping oil companies on their back, making themselves profits back to the people, and Maduro following suit with that basic socialism plan, you know, that's the enemy of capitalism. Of course, America is a war machine. We thrive off of that. We profit off of that.
Yeah, and it's so such mild socialism, too. I mean, all he asked for was 51% of the profits to go to the Venezuelan people. I don't see how that is in any way excessive.
No, right. Exactly. But I think that there's multiple end results. I think that the more you kind of do the research, the more you come to the realization that Cuba is on target, Venezuela with their oil is on target, Nicaragua is on target. I mean, we all know that Latin America, for many reasons, have been on target. I mean, I just feel like it's very funny to talk to like-minded comrades that feel very strongly about Trump and that feel like maybe I do, that he's basically a puppet, and it's leading to all this rise in fascism and white nationalism. But yet we're kind of doing that with Guaido.
Well, I want to, I'm glad to hear that Spanish language media is reporting more of what is actually happening. I think that this war needs to be opposed, A, because it's a war and it's immoral, B, because it's an unjust war based on lies and based on imperialism and an effort to steal the oil and the gold, but also because it will give more power to Trump. And I really, I think you're right. He doesn't want to leave.
Yeah, you're right. Thank you so much for my time, and thank you for all you do.
Thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Maduro announced last week that Venezuela is willing to buy all food products which Brazil is willing to sell to them, and announced that a 7.5-ton shipment of medicines from Russia arrived in the Caribbean nation over the weekend in coordination with the Pan American Health Organization. The corporate mainstream media has conveniently ignored the pointed criticisms voiced by the UN, the IRC, and other 70 Venezuelan and international humanitarian organizations over Washington's politicization of aid efforts, nor have international outlets reported that both the UN and the IRC have recently announced that they will be increasing long-existing aid initiatives in the country in coordination with the Maduro administration. And speaking for myself, of course, this is something that CNN does, and it's easy to start going along with the CNN commentators if you watch them, because they do a lot of good work on what's actually happening with Trump and on the road to impeachment. I call it impeachment porn, and I enjoy watching it. But they're not your friends. They're not on your side. CNN is on the side of imperialism. It's not a coincidence that whenever the U.S. starts firing off those giant rockets from their capital ships, that the UN cameraman is on board. He got on board a month previous when the thing sailed off and was ready to go there. They don't they coordinate with the Pentagon, and their coverage is therefore seamless. They love that stuff on both ends. Okay, the third point of four, how many soldiers deserted? VenezuelaAnalysis.com writes, if all the above wasn't bad enough, the international media is regurgitating unsubstantiated claims from the U.S. government, Colombian authorities, and the Organization of American States that more than 100 Venezuelan soldiers deserted on February 23rd, a figure which Mike Pence elevated to 200 on Monday. Colombian authorities further increased their official counts to over 300 on Tuesday. To date, no clear evidence for these claims has been provided, and given the political interests of the players, they should elicit skepticism. Now, here again, I speak for myself. Now, if 300 soldiers had deserted, that would be significant, and it might be the start of a flood. And Americans want to believe, of course, that the United States is doing the right thing, and that the regime that they're attacking deserves to be attacked. And so people would be deserting it out of morality or out of self-interest or whatever. But it isn't happening. It's made up. And it's the sort of over-the-top war propaganda that makes me think that Bolton and Abrams and Trump are serious about starting a war against Venezuela. The most famous desertion, they write, took place, and here desertion is in scare quotes, in the early hours of February 23rd when three Venezuelan National Guardmen drove a pair of armored cars across the Simon Bolivar Bridge and handed themselves over to Colombian authorities. Prior to surrendering to Colombian forces, the rogue guardsmen had rammed their vehicles into the barrier on the Venezuelan side of the bridge, injuring a police officer and a Chilean photojournalist in what eyewitnesses reported as a deliberate effort to injure the bystanders. I'm going to go to the next caller. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and Jack is on the air.
Yeah, I'm good to hear you mentioning the impeachment porn. Yeah, it's really overtaking the left liberal progressives this obsession with the POTUS. It's blinded by hate, is what I call it. Focus to get people to focus on facts and details, and not take spurious, specious stuff and just throw it out there, because it makes you look bad if you do that. You really got to get your stuff right. And the thing is that what you got now is left liberal progressives rallying around Mueller, for crying out loud, Mueller. The biggest cover-up, the guy who was put in charge of covering up 9/11, basically. And what I warn people is, be careful. The enemy of your enemy is your enemy. And it's your cause. I applaud the cause, but just look a little more closely at what you're sourcing and putting out there to achieve your end.
Yeah, the Federal Bureau of Investigation hasn't exactly been on the side of the people. Although it's I've noticed that there's a long-term effort to pretend that it is. For example, I remember the most egregious example in my mind, even after all these years, is the movie Mississippi Burning, in which the FBI switches roles, and instead of helping the racists, they're helping the anti-racists. It's as absurd as that.
Well, things can be very confusing in this spook world. So I just tell people to look a little more closely as to what you're sourcing. Thank you.
Good point. Thanks for calling. The number to call, 503-231-8187. So I was talking about the desertions. And the desertions, I'll get to some more details here, but they're bogus. And it's war propaganda. It's very familiar to me as someone who's commented on and analyzed war propaganda for decades. This is very familiar stuff. The idea that there's 300 desertions when apparently there's maybe 3 or 7, it's not certain, but anyway, returning to the text, further on the spot video footage also shows the Venezuelan opposition activists on the Colombian side telling local police that the alleged deserters are, quote, ours, they're with us, hinting that it may have been a pre-planned desertion. Excuse me. While no exact numbers exist of soldiers who left their posts on Saturday, the claims being circulated by the mainstream media so far have not been backed by photographic or video evidence or on-the-ground reports. And that's what VenezuelaAnalysis.com writes. And, I'm even more skeptical. I mean, this is just very typical stuff. It doesn't... I've noticed that the hysteria, the outrageousness of claims gets... The tales get taller as the deadline approaches, whatever it is. Just before... Ronald Reagan was reelected. If you look at the New York Times for the day before Election Day, you can find an article saying that the Soviet Union was sneaking aircraft into the harbor in Managua, in Nicaragua, with the implication that this was an existential threat to the United States, that these Soviet warplanes might attack. The grain was offloaded from the ships. There were no aircraft in there. All the grain poured out. None of the grain magically transformed itself into attack aircraft. It was just made up out of whole cloth, because at that time the spook community was four square behind Ronald Reagan, and they had a good deal going there with Bush the Elder, Bush the Greater being the real power behind the throne, and they were getting entirely what they wanted and expanding wildly. So they decided they'd just put some straight-up BS in the New York Times, and it's still there. Going to the fourth item, did the aid contain medicine? Another canard reproduced by... I love the word canard. Reproduced by the international media is the notion that Washington's aid shipment contained, in addition to food, essential medicines for sick Venezuelans condemned to die by Maduro. Sky News reports, quote, almost 200 tons of aid in a convoy of trucks has been waiting to cross several border bridges, including food and medicine, and the tear gas was fired as protesters tried to stop the aid from being destroyed, end quote. However, this assertion has been called into question since Saturday. According to New York Times reporter Anatoly Kermanev, the trucks that the opposition tried to force across the border contained no medicine at all, with reports that a small amount of medicine was being stockpiled in Cucuta, not confirmed by USAID. In initial inventories from USAID made no mention of medicine, listing only basic food and personal hygiene products amongst the aid. And here again, aid is in scare quotes. So the number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. This is Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and I can turn to some other topics. One thing that I've been trying to keep in discussion is the Green New Deal. Now, in contrast to the Green New Deal, And I want to say that I don't agree with everything that's being promoted as a Green New Deal, especially the nuclear industry is trying to get in on that. That's ridiculous. Nuclear is not green. And I can go into why that is so. Number to call 503-231-8187. But there's still an offer happening right now that's not the Green New Deal, and I'm going to call it the Old Dead Deal. Since the backlash to the new Green Deal has started up in earnest, it may be helpful to have a look at the Old Dead Deal and see what's in it for you and me. What can you get right now under the terms of the Old Dead Deal? You can't get into college because it costs too much. Or else, you can get in so long as you're willing to make the equivalent of a steep house mortgage payment for the next couple of generations. That's without actually getting a house, of course. You can start on that in your 40s. Since the Old Dead Deal doesn't offer you decent wages in the meantime, You know, I just said that spuriously, and I realized, no, wait, people are still paying their college loans in their 40s, so that's even that isn't true. That's how cruel it is. Since the Old Dead Deal doesn't offer you decent wages in the meantime, you can look forward to spending your youth in poverty, desperately working multiple jobs to pay for that way too high rent. The Old Dead Deal is terrific for rich financial industry types and for landowners who got theirs before the Great Recession, or more likely in the Clinton era, while their wages were considerably more robust than rent. You should make better life choices, say Old Dead Dealers, who chose to be very, very intelligently, chose to be born white in the middle 20th century and or chose to get substantial inheritance from the start like Donald Trump. The Old Dead Deal left plenty of planet to play around with back then. No super hurricanes to deal with. No mass bee death wiping out the crops, nor ocean dead zones wiping out the fish. Nope. Terms of the Old Dead Deal were to eat it up all now. Or rather then, so, too bad. Our old dead generation got it all. Too bad for you crazy new green dealers who want it all. Teeming life and abundant work, that was for our old dead generation. And you're too late to save. You're too late to the banquet. So hurry up with my order of fries. You want to get a living wage and save the planet? That's socialist talk. Socialism is not allowed because we're free to make choices in this country as long as it's not socialism. And so long as it is a choice to devote the flower of your youth and the strength that you have to people who are already rich. You ingrates. Why, when I was your age, I was happy with two or three times what you have. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I've been trying to debunk the lies against Venezuela. I've been talking about high crimes and misdemeanors here and in Israel. There's news in Haaretz, if you didn't hear at the top of the hour. Netanyahu is being indicted. And it all sounds rather familiar. Number call 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Now, as well as the new Green Deal, support for Medicare for All is rapidly gaining momentum in Congress. And according to an article in Common Dreams, insurance investors are starting to get nervous. Speaking for myself, I think this is a great angle to report because one of the things that you're told, along with the Green New Deal, you're told that Medicare for All just isn't practical, basically that you can't have it and that it's unrealistic to ask for it. Well, apparently that's not the case anymore, because as they write, health insurance stocks tanked on Wednesday as Representative Pramila Jayapal introduced comprehensive Medicare for All legislation with the backing of more than 100 House Democrats and major progressive organizations, including America's largest nurses union and national consumer advocacy groups. They write, the S&P, this is a quote, the S&P 500 managed healthcare index plunged as much as 4.9%, the most since December 6th, led by United Health Group Incorporated, Humana Incorporated, and WellCare Health Plans. That's according to, end quote, that's according to Bloomberg, after Jayapal unveiled her bill during an event on Capitol Hill. Also quoting insurers United Health and Cigna Corp, which also own the country's largest pharmacy benefit managers, were both down about 4%, so they're scared of it. Jayapal quickly made it clear that she has no sympathy for the insurance industry, tweeting in response to the news, sorry, not sorry. Under Jayapal's plan, the U.S. would transition to a Medicare for All system over a period of 2 years and private insurance would be nearly eliminated. Do you have comments on Medicare for All? Do you have comments on war with Venezuela, on the on Trump, the situation that we have with Trump now that he is very likely to be indicted once he resigns the presidency or once he is driven from office? Therefore, it is Michael, well, let me rephrase it. Michael Cohen has said that he was not inclined to leave office peacefully at all. And now it would appear that he can't leave office peacefully and not go to jail. So if you run that through the Trump algorithm, that means that he ain't giving up office, which means that we have to get down with impeachment. What do you think about that? Number to call, 503-231-8187. And Forrest is on the air.
Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
I wanted to get back to the topic of Israeli corruption and more specifically the stranglehold that Israeli power has in this country over our process. Specifically, I want to remind KBOO listeners of the fact that right now, this very moment, there is legislation before Congress that will make it a punishable crime involving prison time to participate in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And relative to local interest, our darling Senator Ron Wyden is in favor of imprisoning American citizens for participating in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And I think that is just one more outrage to add to the pile of outrages that you're talking about today. And I'm curious to know if you happen to know what Jeff Merkley's position on this is, because if he, in fact, is going to vote in favor of this, he is a hypocrite of the grandest order, because here he is gaining media attention for being down on the border trying to defend the rights of oppressed people. And if he votes for this legislation on BDS, he is just willing to throw the Palestinians' access to human rights, you know, down the toilet, because that's exactly what it would do. And not only that, but it would infringe upon our quote-unquote constitutionally protected rights.
Let's talk about Israel for a minute. I think it needs to be talked about in general terms. I don't like, I'm going to frame this a little differently, I don't like what the U.S. has done to and has forged out of Israel, creating a desperate and dependent garrison state. And when I say desperate, I don't mean economically. I mean militarily dependent garrison state in the Middle East for the purpose of enforcing U.S. oil corporations' profits. And to do this, U.S. citizens, who are often also Israeli citizens, have so perverted the political process, and Netanyahu is the perfect example of this, so that it is impossible for rationality and compassion to gain hold in a system in the Knesset where the debate is always framed as if Hitler were around the corner. And for this, I blame Hitler. How can a people not be traumatized after what happened? But for this, I also blame the U.S. greedy, subsidized petroleum corporations and their hold over our government, and the fact that in Israel and in the U.S., what we have is an oligarchy of the rich. We do not have a democracy. We like to flavor it the democracy and claim that it is, and claim that we're going around the world supporting democracy, but that's not what's happening. And so we have billions of dollars every year in tax, U.S. taxpayer money, which was, you know, never, it's so much that it really should have been approved by a plebiscite, and that's never happened, going to Israel and maintaining this artificial, grotesque, belligerent, political entity, as it is, always depending on the fear, the terror that another Hitler will arise. The Palestinian people are tired of being called Hitlers and smeared as collaborators with Hitler and all that sort of thing. So this is what we do, and then there's a tremendous blowback, of course, after generations of doing this. There are Israelis. And Israeli corporations and Israeli organizations that have tremendous and outrageous and anti-sovereign influence in the United States government. That's the way I frame it. Do you think I'm close?
Well, yeah, I think you're close, but I come back to my question. Do you happen to know what Jeff Merkley's position is on this anti-BDS legislation?
Not off the top of my head, and I really should.
Yeah, I don't either. It isn't getting talked about very much. Ron Wyden is up front. He's the very beginning. He wholeheartedly supports it, and the guy is a charlatan, and I've never liked the man, but at any rate, I just think KBOO listeners need to be aware of this. But again, it is one more outrage to add to the pile of outrages, and it's getting to be a quite large pile.
Okay, here's an article on Merkley from May 14th of last year, and it's titled, Merkley Palestinians See Embassy Move as the End of the Two-State Solution. And so it quotes Merkley, saying, the situation is certainly horrific, and I think that symbolically this move represents for many Palestinians the end of their hopes for a two-state solution, referring to the idea that Palestinian state and Israeli state can coexist. I didn't close the quote sufficiently, but here's more of a quote from Merkley. The symbolism really represents to people living in the West Bank and Gaza that there's no path for them ever to have a land of their own. They've been under occupation, end quotes. That's from Merkley. Here's another quote. It's an extraordinarily difficult life, and we, the United States, have championed the vision that there would be a future, a brighter future ahead, end quote. So just from that, I would say that he is not as rabid as Wyden on this. You know, and it's always been a pain for me because Wyden does so many good things and stands up for so many good things. But over the years, when he acts like he is acting, I've often referred to him as Senator Merkley R. Israel.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I misspoke. Senator Wyden R. Israel is what I meant to say.
Right. Well, there was commentary before your show on KBOO about, in fact, I think it was Joanne talking about the influence of money in Oregon and how Oregon is so far behind on environmental legislation as to our neighboring states. Ron Wyden, it was known widely that back in the day when I was involved with protesting the logging of old growth timber and so on, Ron Wyden got more donations from industrial timber than any senator in the country. So take that with you too.
Yeah, and that's been going on for a long time. Stumps Hatfield comes to mind, and it kind of brings up that whole flavor of Oregon as Baja Washington. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you.
Got 4 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This show is called Press Watch. We'll go to the next caller, 503-231-8187. Hi, Chris. Bruce, I'm sorry.
Hi.
Go ahead, Bruce.
Hi. I just want to tell the listeners that the tentacles of U.S. imperialism extended well into the counterculture regarding Venezuela. You had John Oliver up there stumping for regime change and accusing Maduro of being some sort of despot. You had Saturday Night Live mocking Hugo Chavez a couple of weeks after he died of cancer, a Justin Timberlake skit mocking him. So U.S. imperialism has infiltrated the counterculture. They didn't need much help. They're leaning that way anyway. So we have to be careful about assuming that some people that bash Trump and why not will necessarily be opposed to U.S. intervention in Venezuela. We see Pelosi. We see these people preparing for some sort of an incursion into Venezuela. And I'd say be very careful of state-sponsored satire like Saturday Night Live and people like John Oliver. They're the ones greasing the skids.
I think there's some truth to what you say because people look to, I mean, John Oliver as a clown has done more work against negative U.S. policies than many a journalist. And so people learn and they turn to him and they learn about things that they weren't aware of or angles of it. And he has done a great deal for justice. And so when he comes around and slides into the casual U.S. attitude, which I think is based on it all goes back to corporate reporting and to the effective censorship of alternative media, the effective censorship of international media that happens when we have these few corporations monopolizing the news, the monopoly media, as Big Dickian called it all those years ago. They're all in bed with the arms industry. Certainly NBC is wholly owned by General Electric. And people are bamboozled by this, right up to even immigrants like John Oliver. Hey, thanks for your call. I think I have run out of time, and it's getting around time to... I'll just check with the engineer and see if we have time for one more caller. Is that the case? Okay, one more. You've got 30 seconds. Maybe 20. Go ahead.
Okay. My name's Roger. I ran the Consumer Fraud Department in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office 40 years ago, and I've been going after the corruption that's going on in the system. And they were arresting me for trying to speak in these courtrooms. That's the level of corruption that's going on in the Multnomah County court system. And that's the problem. I've been going around the state and around the country talking to other people as a former prosecutor.
Okay, give a website because we're out of time. Give a website.
Yeah.
Give a URL.
So, I'm
sorry to interrupt you. I really am, but I'm out of time. And you've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, and you've been listening on 90.7 FM in Cascadia and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time chief engineer. Applications are due by midnight on Monday, March 4th to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214, or by emailing engineerhire@kboo.fm. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regards to the minimum qualifications and by answering the following question. Why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/engineer2019. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, for more information, go to kboo.fm/engineer2019.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. We have at 10, The Heather McCoy Show, at 11, Between the Covers, and then at 11:30, we have Words and Pictures. So, coming up next is The Heather McCoy Show on KBOO Portland.